The following program, The Russ Belville Show, is intended for responsible adults only. We advocate to the repeal of marijuana prohibition for adults. We discuss the science, culture, and controversy about America's marijuana laws. We do not advocate any illegal activity and encourage all listeners to learn their state and federal marijuana laws. Opinions and claims made by guests and advertisers on The Russ Belville Show are their own, and The Russ Belville Show cannot be held legally responsible for their validity or reliability. Viewer discretion is advised.
You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it,
and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
From the promise of legalization. To the agony of prohibition.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
The Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
I hear you had a question for me.
Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Belville.
We love it.
Good day, Tokers and Tokettes, and welcome to the show. It is Monday, June 17th, 2013, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. It's got to be about 420 degrees here in Scottsdale, Arizona. All right, it's not that hot. It's only about 108. But we are still here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I flew out this weekend to join up with the Effin' Normal Tour for the tour dates here in Arizona. I had a friend fly out from Miami, wanted to see the shows. And, there were no shows. The FNA's tour bus broke down in Dallas shortly after getting it purchased. Quite the deal, huh? But no worries. It's fixed now. Had to replace some oxygen sensors, something like that. The FNA's tour bus is ready to roll, and they'll be coming through here to pick me up on Wednesday on our way to San Diego, where we open the tour at the World Beat Center in San Diego, California on the 20th, I believe. Although, there's been so many dates that have been added recently that I can't remember all of them. I do know we're going to Oklahoma City in August, so that'll be interesting. But you can check out my Facebook page, facebook.com/radicalrust/events should give you the information you need to know if you're trying to catch up with us on the Effin' Normal Tour. And if you'd like to donate, sponsor the tour, get your company's name or brand or product or service or idea out in front of all these people across all these states we're going to tour, you can get a hold of me at 420 Radio, go to our contact page, or get a hold of the Effin' Normal Tour at effinnormal.com. Hey, plenty of stuff on today's show, though. I got all sorts of news to get to. And first of all, we have got an amazing situation in Florida, where, of course, Governor Rick Scott has signed the bong ban bill. We'll tell you about the bong ban, and also we'll compare and contrast that to what happened to Walgreens for pushing millions of oxycodone pills illegally. Quite a difference in what happened there. Also, we've got a new study, once again, confirming that kids in medical marijuana states are no more likely to use marijuana than kids in non-medical marijuana states. We've also got Dr. Mitch Earlywine joining us for our cannabis Q&A session, so get into our chat room or call us live at 971-533-7111 to get your questions answered live. We'll ask Dr. Mitch about those studies as well. We got a Daily Toker tune for this Father's Day that took place on Sunday as well. Stick around for a blast for the past. I'm Radical Russ from Scottsdale. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back after these messages from our 420 friendly sponsors. Support these advertisers because their ad money goes straight to the Russ Belville Show. You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
The law offices of Omar Figueroa would like to remind you to stand up for your rights. Please do not give up your precious liberties. There's nothing wrong with standing up for our constitutional rights, and in fact, it's the only way to honor the Constitution that recognizes our natural rights. Treat law enforcement with respect and respect the Constitution by standing up for your rights. If you are detained or arrested, stand up for your rights by repeating, I respectfully invoke all my legal and constitutional rights. I do not consent to any search and seizure. I want to remain silent, and I want to speak to my attorney, Omar Figueroa. Omar Figueroa has more than a decade of experience in federal and California courts and graduated from Yale University, Stanford Law School, and Trial Lawyers College. Please contact the law offices of Omar Figueroa at 415-489-0420 or 707-829-0215 or on the web at www.omarfigueroa.com. This is your 420 Radio News for Monday, June 17th, 2013. I'm Russ Belville. U.S. Supreme Court rules that pre-Miranda silence can be used in court. This from Huffington Post. The Supreme Court says prosecutors can use a person's silence against them if it comes before he's told of his right to remain silent. The 5-4 ruling comes in the case of Genovevo Salinas, who was convicted of a 1992 murder. During police questioning, and before he was arrested and read his Miranda rights, Salinas answered some questions, but did not answer when asked if a shotgun he had would match up with the murder weapon. The Fifth Amendment protects Americans against forced self-incrimination, with the Supreme Court saying that prosecutors cannot comment on a defendant's refusal to testify at trial. The courts have expanded that right to answering questions in police custody, with police required to tell people under arrest that they have a right to remain silent without it being used in court. Prosecutors argued that since Salinas was answering some questions, therefore not invoking his right to silence, and since he wasn't under arrest and wasn't compelled to speak, his silence on the incriminating question doesn't get constitutional protections. Salinas's, quote, Fifth Amendment claim fails because he did not expressly invoke the privilege against self-incrimination in response to the officer's question, Justice Samuel Alito writes. It has long been settled that the privilege generally is not self-executing and that a witness who desires its protections must claim it. Maine lawmakers pass measure expanding state's medicinal cannabis program from the Normal blog. House and Senate lawmakers last week gave final approval to legislation LD 1062 to allow patients diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, inflammatory bowel disease, and other debilitating disorders to be able to engage in the therapeutic use of cannabis. The measure expands the list of qualifying conditions for which a Maine physician may legally recommend cannabis to include post-traumatic stress disorder, inflammatory bowel disease, dyskinetic and spastic movement disorders, and other diseases causing severe and persistent muscle spasms. It is the second time that Maine legislatures have acted to expand the pool of patients who may have access to cannabis therapy. Four states, Connecticut, Delaware, New Mexico, and Oregon, specifically allow for the use of cannabis to treat symptoms of post-traumatic stress, as well as California's general allowance for any other illness for which marijuana may provide relief. Marijuana Initiative gets closer to Alaska ballot from KTOO.org. An initiative to set up a legal marijuana market has cleared a hurdle for getting on the ballot in 2014. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell certified that the initiative language conformed with the Alaska statute this afternoon, just one day short of his deadline. That means initiative sponsors can start circulating petitions to show that a sufficient number of Alaskans want to vote on the issue. The sponsors need more than 30,000 signatures to do that. Right now, Alaskans are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana in their homes, but the sale of marijuana is still a crime. Officials want to ban smoking medical marijuana in public from Boston Magazine. State Representative Cleon Turner's idea is simple and straightforward. Quote, I want to provide municipalities, landlords, property owners, and business owners the opportunity to prohibit smoking marijuana, whether for medical purposes or otherwise, on their property, end quote, said the Democrat who represents the Cape Cod town of Dennis. In the language of four separate bills filed by Turner, which will go before the Joint Committee on the Judiciary, depending on the legislation, various entities would have the power to keep people who use marijuana for medicinal purposes from lighting up the drug in designated areas, even inside their own apartments. The Mayo Clinic says teens with chronic pain should not use medical marijuana, from CBSNews.com. Teens with chronic pain should not be prescribed medical marijuana, according to the Mayo Clinic. Due to a lack of information on the risks and benefits of medical marijuana for adolescents, the Mayo Clinic is not recommending that youth be given pot for pain conditions. While the drug may help alleviate some of their other conditions or symptoms, marijuana can lead to some negative short-term side effects, including fatigue, impaired concentration, and slower reaction times. Dr. J. Michael Bostwick, a Mayo Clinic psychiatrist, said in a press release, quote, "The consequences may be very, very severe, particularly for adolescents who may get rid of their pain, or not, at the expense of the rest of their life," end quote. This has been your 420 Radio News for Monday, June 17th, 2013. I'm Russ Belville. When we come back, we go behind the headlines of the latest study showing that the enacting of medical marijuana laws at the state level does not lead to an increase in teen marijuana use. You're listening to The Russ Belville Show on 420 Radio. We'll be right back after this. Woodpipe Smoke Shop and Speakeasy is your source for cannabis community gear in southern Wisconsin. Owners Brian and Tammy Wood are located in Kendall, just outside of Madison, and they've got everything for the smoking enthusiast, including a full assortment of pipes, water pipes, hookahs, bubblers, one-hitters, and so much more. They're open noon to 8 p.m. Monday through Saturday and can help you with your detoxification therapies as well. Call 608-466-7473 or email woodpipes@yahoo.com for more information. That's 608-466-7473 or email woodpipes@yahoo.com. And as always, go Pack, go!
Hey everybody, welcome. It's Danny Danko from High Times Magazine, and I'm here with Mr. Kyle Cushman, and we're talking about integrated pest management. Now Kyle, I see you're using these yellow sticky traps. What's the purpose of those?
It is just a good part of routine IPM, integrated pest management, along with neem oil, regular spraying of neem oil every second or third day. And it's just good to keep down to prevent an infestation before it happens. Okay. So it's kind of like that canary in the coal mine thing where it'll let you know ahead of time by seeing how many bugs there if you need to employ something stronger, if you're going to need to use biological controls or some chemical insecticides.
Wow, cool. And also I'd like people to know the reason these sticky traps are yellow is that the bugs are attracted to that color. It's the color of a dying leaf, which makes a welcome home for them. So always remove any yellowing leaves so as not to create a home for pests.
Yes. Yellow Amato leaves. Go away.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kyle. And this has been a lesson in integrated pest management.
Warning, hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
Welcome back, everybody. Time for us to go behind the headlines. And there was a great study got forwarded to me today by Paul Armentano at Normal. And among a few other people that brought it to my attention. This is a study that says that state medical marijuana laws do not lead to more teen pot use. According to a new study published in the American Journal of Public Health, researchers at the University of Florida College of Medicine in Gainesville have determined that the enactment of state medical marijuana laws does not lead to an increase in teen marijuana use. Now, personally, one of the things I love about this story is it's from the University of Florida, home of Kevin Sabet and his whole Project Sam and his whole Drug Policy Institute. So researchers at his own university are contradicting some of his scare lines. Love it. Anyway, the researchers used data from 2003 through 2011. They compiled it from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey for the states of Montana, Rhode Island, Michigan, and Delaware. Now, in their conclusions, the researchers wrote this, quote, "Our results suggest that in the states assessed here, medical marijuana laws have not measurably affected adolescent marijuana use in the first few years after their enactment. Longer-term results after medical marijuana laws are more fully implemented might be different," end quote. All right, so I can already hear Kevin Sabet, you know, and what his response to this would be. And I think he would probably say, well, it's only four of the states, Montana, Rhode Island, Michigan, and Delaware. And you're not counting like Colorado and California that have these massive dispensary operations. And we're only talking about short term, not long term. What happens after they've been around for a long time? But the problem for Kevin and all the rehab industry shills out there is that there are other studies, and this is just confirming what we've already found out. It confirms the results of a study that was done in 2012. The German Institute for the Study of Labor published some work by university researchers at Montana State University, University of Oregon, and the University of Colorado at Denver. This study was entitled Medical Marijuana Laws and Teen Use. The researchers, Anderson, Hansen, and Rees, examined the same youth risk behavior survey, but instead of the 2003 to 2011 that the latest study is going over, this one went over 1993 through 2009. Now, 1993, that's important because now we've got some data pre-medical marijuana, right? 1996 is when California first passed medical marijuana, being the first state, right? So we got some before and after shots, so to speak. And in their research, they covered what were then the 13 medical marijuana states, and this was their conclusion, quote, "Our results are not consistent with the hypothesis that the legalization of medical marijuana caused an increase in the use of marijuana and other substances among high school students," end quote. Not only did medical marijuana laws not cause kids to use more marijuana, didn't increase the use of other substances as well. So much for that gateway drug theory, right? And Marijuana Policy Project in 2011, they updated their study, which was entitled Marijuana Use by Young People, the Impact of State Medical Marijuana Laws. It was written by Karen O'Keefe and our own Dr. Mitch Earlywine, and they made the following conclusions. In California, which has the longest term, most detailed available data shows an overall decrease in teen marijuana use. In Washington State, which passed its law in 1998, sixth and eighth graders' current and lifetime marijuana use has dropped significantly. Data from Oregon, whose law passed in 1998, suggest modest declines in marijuana use among the two grades surveyed. Data from Alaska, which passed its law in 1998, show a moderate decrease in high schoolers' current marijuana use and a slight decrease in their lifetime use. In Maine, which passed its law in 1999, available data on teen marijuana use suggest usage has decreased or stayed the same for every age group. In Hawaii and Nevada, which both passed laws in 2000, high schoolers' current and lifetime marijuana use has decreased since the enactment of state laws. Colorado, which also passed its law in 2000, is the only state without an in-depth statewide survey, but the limited data available suggest a modest decrease in Colorado teens' marijuana usage. Data from Vermont, which passed its law in 2004, indicate a modest decline in teens' current marijuana use, as well as declines at all surveyed individual grade levels. Data from Montana suggest a small decline in high schoolers' lifetime marijuana use since the 2004 passage of the state's medical marijuana law, and no change in their current marijuana use. In Rhode Island, which passed its law in January 2006, lifetime youth marijuana use has decreased slightly since the law passed, though current use has increased slightly. New Mexico, which enacted a medical marijuana law in April 2007, shows slight increases in current teen marijuana use rates, which coincide with increases at the national level over the same time period. In Michigan, which passed its law in November 2008, the data show mixed results with use rates, both current and lifetime, down in 9th and 10th grades, but up in the 11th and 12th grades, And nationwide, teenage marijuana use has decreased in the more than 14 years since California enacted the country's first effective medical marijuana law. So there you have it. We have retired that talking point. That scare tactic is done. Medical marijuana laws do not cause more kids to smoke pot. But 420 causes me to. We'll be right back.
Have you ever met that funny reefer man? Reefer man. Have you ever met that funny reefer man? Reefer man. If he said he swam to China, he would sell you South Carolina. Then you know you're talking to that reefer man.
NORML stands for Responsible Adult Cannabis Use. If cannabis use is causing problems in your life, consider taking a break or seeking medical assistance. Consider ceasing cannabis use if you have a family history of mental illness. Don't drive or operate heavy machinery while impaired by cannabis use. Cannabis use is not without risks, even though the risks may be far less than those posed by legal drugs.
Fun.
What's happening, cool cats? This is Big Daddy, and I want you to cruise on over to the Funky Roller Rink. We'll be grooving all night long. Doors open at 11 Eastern, 8 Pacific, every Thursday night, right here on RadicalRuss.com.
Funky. Delicious.
Everyone knows music and marijuana go together, so let's wind up our 20 after break with the Russ Belleville Show's Daily Toker Tunes, the best in pod-safe 420 music from around the web. Today is Roots Monday, featuring the blues, country, folk, and jazz music that birthed the modern sounds we enjoy today. You can get downloads and more information about all our Daily Toker Tunes by visiting music.radicalrust.com. Now, sit back and enjoy your Daily Toker Tunes.
Welcome back, folks. I'll tell you one thing, being on the road certainly has helped, is my ability to roll joints out of necessity, so to speak. But welcome to our Toker Talk Radio, Toker Tunes. Gosh, it's not Toker Talk Radio yet. Anyway, too many time zones. I'm all messed up. Today, for our Daily Toker Tunes, what I wanted to get to, of course, was, well, a little tribute to yesterday. Yesterday was Father's Day all around this country. And, you know, watching Facebook, I saw all of the tweets and the Facebook posts from people all across cyberspace, you know, saying happy Father's Day. So I put one out myself, and I don't know if the picture's on the cam right now or not, but if it is, there's an old black and white picture there. That's my dad, the Rockin' Johnny B. Yes, the penchant for nicknames goes way back. The Rockin' Johnny B, a.k.a. John Belleville, with me. He's about 25 years old in that picture, and that's me about a few months old in that picture. And, you know, I just wanted to dedicate this to my dad, you know, for Father's Day, because, you know, he was a professional musician. It led a lot to me playing music and getting on the road and being in front of people and, you know, long story short, being in front of you right now on the internet. So this goes out to my dad. It's music from one of his albums. His band, he just retired playing music. He and Friendly Henry have been playing together since the 80s. Two guys, you know, great friends. Friendly Henry's in his, like, I guess he's 79, 80, something like that. So they finally retired from going to clubs and playing music and setting up. But, you know, that's my dad. That's the dad I remember, is the Rockin' Johnny B, you know, always having a club gig somewhere, always being on the road, always setting up. And so in celebration of Father's Day, I thought I'd bring up this Waylon Jennings classic that he performed with his band, The Knights. This is The Only Daddy That'll Walk the Line.
I'm going to do another one of Waylon's. This is the first song me and old Friendly Henry ever did together back in 1969, wasn't it?
No, 68.
Oh, my God, it was worse than I
thought. Wow.
It's when we first got together and first talked to each other, became friends, was back in those days. And this was a song that I climbed up on the bandstand and just chucked it right out to the audience, just right there. I looked good, too.
I don't think I was a twinkle at that time.
Are you ready, son? Your father knows you've been stepping on my toes. I'm getting real tired of this. You keep on stepping out of line and messing with my mind. You had any sense you quit? Ever since you were a little bitty teeny girl, said I was the only vibe. You got the old lick daddy that'll walk the line.
It's time we legalize the responsible use of marijuana and stop treating marijuana smokers like criminals. We're destroying the lives and careers of hundreds of thousands of good, hardworking Americans every year in this country for no good reason. There's absolutely nothing wrong with smoking pot. For more information on how you can help legalize marijuana, please contact Normal at norml.org.
It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pens the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We're live with Dr. Mitch Earlywine on the line. How are you doing, Dr. Mitch?
Having a great day.
I'm having a great day, too. A whole bunch of it. It's like 108 degrees out here. So I just wanted to let you know, I got my sunscreen, and I'm drinking plenty of fluids.
You know how I love that hydration.
I love it, too. All right, so folks, if you're new to the segment here, every Monday, Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us to take your cannabis-related questions on science, culture, history, and health. You can get them into our chat room. If you put a capital Q colon, that'll kind of highlight it, so it makes it easier for us to find. But we always start off by giving Dr. Mitch the first word here on what the latest studies are regarding cannabis and its users. What's happening, Dr. Mitch?
Well, Russ, you already did such a great job on that teen use research that just came out, confirming that, in fact, medical marijuana laws don't increase teen use. I just want to compliment you on what a great methodologist you've become over the years, and you're a herb consumer of research now. I would like to point folks towards the Humboldt Journal of Social Relations, which has a superb article by Dr. Wendy Chapkis, who some folks know from the University of Southern Maine. She's spoken at normal conferences and a number of conferences before, and it's called The Trouble with Mary Jane's Gender, and really focuses on how, in some ways, the movement has neglected women. Some of the depictions of women in cannabis are more sexist than we'd probably be proud of, and that women are the ones who vote. Women voted higher percentages than men, particularly at the younger ages, and that, you know, the movement really needs to reach out and find out what do women want and how can we get them to help in ending the war on drugs.
Well, and especially when we see the women's support for marijuana legalization usually lags 5 to 10 points behind that of men's. If they're voting more often, that's even more exacerbated. So we've got to find out what women are all about on the marijuana issue. A lot of great activist groups out there that are working on this. Normal Women's Alliance, Moms for Marijuana. And in fact, there's been some publications now, I understand, Ladybud.com, our friend and Normal board member Diane Fornbacher running that organization. So lots of outlets out there, Dr. Mitch.
It's delightful, actually, to see how Ladybud has taken off, and I'm just really intrigued. I'm training my own students and getting as many women as involved as I can, but here's a chance for us men to shut up and listen, and so I really want to take advantage of that.
All right, and I wanted to ask also, with regard to this, you know, this study, the teen marijuana use hasn't gone up. I always look to the future, and we've got more states that are legalizing outright for recreational use, and we've got a chatter who comes onto our show boards quite a bit who worries about, you know, what's going to happen if we legalize marijuana in Colorado and Washington, and then 2 years later when we get the survey data in, we find, oh my God, teen use went way, way up. And I have a theory, or a hypothesis, I suppose, and I'd like to run it by you, is that if something like that were to happen, if we were to see a spike in use, in reported use, couldn't it be that now that it's legal, there's just more people willing to be honest about what they're already smoking?
In fact, that's absolutely the case. And one of my grad students and I have been talking about trying to gather some data in Colorado and then in neighboring states where they don't have the same kind of laws. We use a technique where you make it more and more anonymous, essentially, and are finding, in fact, that over the years, people are more willing to fess up to having used cannabis, and that some of these elaborate techniques that used to show people were more likely to lie on the surveys are now revealing that, in fact, at least as far as cannabis use is concerned, they don't lie, even though they lie about other things like cheating on exams or snorting coke or things like that. So I'm quite optimistic that that is a compelling explanation for any increases. I want to point out, too, that just as we have some rituals around turning 21 and using a lot of alcohol right on that exact day, we do see in the Netherlands when folks become of age to go to the coffee shops, they do have a big day like that, too. But that I don't want to make too much of this, in fact, because cannabis is nowhere near as lethal or toxic as alcohol, and that if it does show an increase in use, we shouldn't jump to assume that that means an increase in problems. And I feel like that's where the United States has really fallen down, is that we're much more freaked out about taking a puff than we are about folks showing symptoms of dependence. And I think that's where the worry really should be.
Well, sure. And that stat doesn't occur in a vacuum either. If use of marijuana goes up, but drunk driving goes down and binge drinking goes down and prescription drug use goes down, it could be a net good.
Exactly. And it's funny because just bringing that up freaks some people out. They find that inconceivable. We have seen this decrease in binge drinking in at least some larger economic studies, and some curious and interesting decreases in prescription drug use, as well as tons and tons of anecdotal reports about how folks got off hard drugs by using cannabis. So I really want to keep that open.
Absolutely. All right. There was another story we did in the news today. The Mayo Clinic, Dr. J. Michael Bostwick, one of the psychiatrists out there, authored a press release that said that teens with chronic pain should not use medical marijuana because, quote, the consequences may be very, very severe, particularly for adolescents who may get rid of their pain or not
at the expense of the rest of their life, end quote. So, gosh, I guess we should keep giving them Ritalin and other drugs, but not pot.
I mean, it's just so hard to take that kind of drama seriously, you know, at the expense of the rest of their life, right? And in fact, when you look at, you know, some of the problems related to getting strung out on opiates for pain, these certainly pale in comparison and really are jumping the gun here. Yeah, we do see the occasional type 1 error where folks who started heavy use before age 18 have some brain anomalies. If you really put them under the microscope, you might be able to detect them. But compared to what? And I think that that's the key issue is long-term use of the opiates. You know, we've seen tolerance develop rapidly. You get a lot of other potential problems. And nobody's saying, hey, this has to be something that you have to do mega doses every single day so you're just stoned to the bone and can't learn anything or things like that. We've seen tolerance to THC at low doses, particularly doses that are appropriate for pain. We don't want too much because it actually heightens pain. And that the subjective effects show tolerance before the analgesic ones. So some folks can get relief of the pain without really reporting any subjective effects, and that would be perfect and ideal and could get folks through a whole lot cheaper and a whole lot easier than any of the opiate drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're getting some questions coming in from the chat room now here. John Thomas notes, a study that has come out of, let me see if I can get the link here, study has come out from Germany finding that cannabis combats brain degeneration and increases stamina. Have you heard of this study, and does this say that marijuana is now preventative medicine, perhaps?
I haven't seen that individual one. I've seen one comparable about, you know, just battling neurotoxins in general and the chance to, you know, increase neurogenesis. But again, we're getting ahead of the human data. So most of the stuff is still petri dish, you know, individual neuron level or finally into the rodents. We don't know if it's going to generalize. But things like this suggest to me that it's time to really get this research out there and to start funding it. And it's curious because when you call NIDA now, they say it's not our job. So you have to go to these cancer institutes. You have to go to these Alzheimer's groups. You have to go to places where you're really not accustomed to talking marijuana and open up their minds. But slowly but surely, I feel like we're making progress.
All right. That's really, really good news. Now, another bit of good news that we've got going on. Maine just added more conditions to its medical marijuana program, including post-traumatic stress. Oregon just passed a law to add post-traumatic stress. And, I'm happier than anyone to admit when a particular plank in the Box Canyon theory is wrong. And it seems to be, with respect to PTSD, we're getting more and more coverage of these in the medical marijuana states. What do you attribute that to, Dr. Mitch? Is it just people can't vote against the vets, or are they really understanding that this is a valuable medicine for PTSD?
I think it's starting to dawn on people, first of all, that PTSD, whether you believe it's a disorder, blah, 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 people are suffering. And we're also finding that we do have nice behavioral treatments for this, 12-session. They're intense, though. It's very difficult. It's hard work for 3 months. And folks drop out a lot. If they had something that could help them keep their symptoms under wraps while they go through the exposure treatments, that would be extremely productive and could be incredibly potentially helpful. But it's also, when you weigh the costs and benefits, what are the real negative consequences of adult cannabis use versus the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, which are just incredibly debilitating and complete unmitigated hassles? So I think slowly but surely that is dawning on folks. And it's not just patriotism, but if it is, by all means, let's wave that flag.
All right. Well, wouldn't that be an argument, though, for the use of cannabis in just about any disorder that it treats? I mean, it's side effects being so benign compared to most of the pharmaceutical drugs people throw at it that it should be a medicine of first resort.
Well, and it's unfortunate, though, because I do feel like there are a lot of good cognitive behavioral treatments that folks can use to battle depression, to battle anxiety, and to battle post-traumatic stress, and then they could just use cannabis for fun.
There we go. We'll work on that. We're speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine here in our Cannabis Q&A segment. You can call in live at 971-533-7111. Also, a lot of people like to ask the questions through our chat room, so you can get into that through Ustream over on the side of the 420 radio page there. Just click on the pop-up link, and it'll get the chat room available. Or if you're just shy, and I understand some of these things might be personal, you can send in an email through our contact form, 420radio.org/contact. Just go to the drop-down list and pick Ask Dr. Mitch. Or if you'd like to email directly, it's 420research at gmail.com. All right. So the other thing that's going on in the in medical marijuana right now that's kind of interesting. Actually, I'm sorry, not medical marijuana, but in marijuana legalization. And this is a story that I saw come up from the Huffington Post. Leaders of the faith community held a conference called A View from the Pulpit, Faith Leaders and Drug Decriminalization. It was at the American Baptist College, and a lot of it focused on the disproportionate impact of drug laws on minorities, on black people in particular. But I'm just wondering, Dr. Mitch, as we look at this from a sociological point of view, how have religions generally been co-opted in this drug war, and what is now leading them to fight it?
It's interesting because I had a chapter on this in Pot Politics years ago that tried to address this, and it's really a struggle. And I feel like getting the pastors on our side, so to speak, getting the clergy on our side is really important, and they have not been trained to see it this way. They've always been taught that all drugs are evil and that this is, you know, a separation from your spiritual self and things like that. And if they want to go that route, that's fine. But I think these disparate arrest records that have now replicated in New York and other cities and statewide and countrywide now, it's really spooky. I think suddenly this is dawning on them that, hey, this is targeting our people. This is targeting our own parishes here. Literally, my pews are empty because of this war, and suddenly that brings the light on. And I feel like that's definitely the way to pitch it to them is, hey, your church is going to be more full if you're not throwing minority kids in jail at disparate rates.
All right. Yeah, this is a wonderful development, and Drug Policy Alliance had a lot to do with this as well in putting this together. So kudos to them. I've always said if you can get a religious Republican woman to vote for legalization, you've won. And that's we're going a long way there. One other story that came up, brings back Professor David Nutt out there in the UK, who got fired for his views. I think he said using ecstasy was safer than horseback riding, which statistically was true. This was a story that actually Fox News reported of these doctors, a lot of these scientists, saying that the banning and this was David Nutt saying, quote, "The decision to outlaw these drugs, marijuana and some hallucinogens, the decision to outlaw these drugs was based on their perceived dangers, but in many cases, the harms have been overstated, and these laws amount to the worst case of scientific censorship since the Catholic Church banned the works of Copernicus and Galileo," end quote. And as a scientist yourself, I just wanted to know if you had any comments on that story.
Well, I mean, I love Copernicus. It's delightful to see David Nutt come out so strongly on this, but in fact, the data are on his side. And I feel like, in particular, some of the promise we're seeing for the cannabinoids on Alzheimer's and dementia are the things that really inspired him on this one. And that seems like a route that suddenly, with the aging of America, people are really focusing on. As we see our parents slowly and surely, I hate to say it, but lose their minds, we really want to prevent this for ourselves, and this is an opportunity to just get this investigation done. Nobody's saying smoking pot's going to keep you young forever or anything wild like that. We're just saying we'd like to gather these data. Please help us. And they're saying no to that. As soon as you hear that, it's obviously a problem.
All right. Well, Dr. Mitch joins us every Monday here for Cannabis Q&A.
Right.
Thanks, Dr. Mitch.
Messages from our 420 friendly sponsors.
See you next week.
Support these advertisers because their ad money goes straight to the Russ Belville Show.
When we come back, we got time for a little radical rant.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
We're going to take a ranty look at the state of Florida. Stick around.
The Russ Belville Show reminds you to never smoke and drive impaired. Hang out for a while and share.
Cause the day was hard and your work was long, and you need a break from all that's wrong. You better look at the clock, cause it's 4:19. Time to reach in that pocket for your bag of green and smoke that weed.
You want answers?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore!
You want answers?
You have offended my family.
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
And you have offended a Shaolin temple.
You can't handle the truth!
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Radical rant.
In Florida, having a pot pipe is a felony. But illegally pushing millions of OxyContin is a fine. Florida has this massive problem with what's called the OxyContin Express. The state is home to more pill mills where addicts get their hillbilly heroin than any other. Walgreens, the national pharmacy chain, has been under DEA investigation for distribution of millions of OxyContin sales where thousands of sales should have been expected. Yet, the drug Florida's legislature can't stop trying to control isn't OxyContin, it's cannabis. Florida Governor Rick Scott signed into law the Bong Ban Bill this weekend. Under this statute, someone caught owning or selling a pot pipe twice in the state is a felon, which in Florida means losing the right to vote virtually for life. Drug convicts must wait 7 years after the fulfillment of all prison, probation, and parole to apply to a clemency board to consider restoring their voting rights in the state of Florida. This has meant 10% of all voting-age Floridians and a shocking 23% of African-American Floridians cannot vote. Note to bitter Democrats, those votes would have given us President Gore in 2000. Now, this law is fairly toothless at the retail level. You can still sell a corn cob pipe for any purpose. You can still sell hookahs. And you can still sell any pipe, so long as it is for tobacco use only. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Know what I mean? Oh, and as long as 75% of your sales are tobacco-related. But at the consumer level, if you're caught with a used marijuana pipe, it's got to be hard to argue that it was for tobacco use only. You'll get a first-degree misdemeanor and face 1 year in prison the first time you're caught with a pot pipe, and a third-degree felony, and face 5 years in prison if you're caught again. Now, as the former crack addict-turned-representative who sponsored the bill explained, quote, "Rather than just regulating them, let's just ban them. If we can make people drive to Georgia and Alabama and South Carolina to get fireworks, they can drive to get these utensils of death," end quote. And all but five of his colleagues, a 31-2 vote in the Senate and a 112-3 vote in the House, agreed with them. And Florida legislators have repeatedly rejected the Kathy Jordan Medical Marijuana Act, named after the Florida woman who has survived over 2.5 decades with Lou Gehrig's disease after being given 2 years to live, thanks to her use of medical cannabis. The act has not even been debated in the Florida legislature. Manatee County sheriffs even raided Kathy's medical grow the day after the bill was published, with her name and address in the public record giving them the location to search. To their credit, the Jordans refused a plea deal, as Kathy's husband Bob told Normal, quote, "If I could handle Vietnam, I could take whatever the state wants to try and hit me with. I am protecting my wife. No deals, no nothing. I want a trial. I want a jury to see my wife and try to convict her," end quote. The state's attorney decided to drop the charges against her, recognizing an obvious precedent-setting case of medical necessity that he didn't want to have on the Florida books. Meanwhile, the DEA has just settled with Walgreens over the OxyContin distribution investigation. The pharmacy giant will pay an $80 million fine, and its Jupiter, Florida distribution plant and six Florida pharmacies will be banned from distributing Schedule 2, 3, 4, and 5 drugs for the next 6 months. The fine and settlement is expected to cost the giant corporation between 4 and 6 cents a share. $80 million fine for a corporation with quarterly cash flow at about $1.2 billion and quarterly sales of $18.65 billion. That works out to about 0.42% of Walgreens' quarterly sales. A 0.42% fine for a corporation that had one store in Oviedo go from ordering about 80,000 OxyContins to about 1.7 million between 2009 and 2011. It had a store in Hudson that went from 388,000 OxyContins in 2009 to 2.1 million in 2011, and a store in Fort Myers, Florida that went from 95,000 OxyContins in 2009 to 2.2 million OxyContin. Now, to try to put this in perspective, imagine the DEA caught an average American with a $45,000 annual income diverting millions of OxyContin on the black market, and then settled with that American for a $47.25 fine and no criminal charges. Yeah, right. USA Today reports that Miami Field District Special Agent in Charge, Mark Trowville, said, quote, "Walgreens pharmacists blatantly ignored red flags. National pharmaceutical chains are not exempt from following the law," end quote. Yeah, but national pharmaceutical chains corporate officers tasked with following the law don't do any jail time or lose their right to vote. However, a medical marijuana patient in Florida caught with 21 grams of marijuana will face 5 years in prison and never vote again. The DEA, by the way, is playing Walgreens for a sucker. They knew all along that Florida's OxyContin Express was fueling the entire Eastern hillbilly heroin market because they were greenlighting it. As Alternet reported back in 2011, the DEA has an Office of Diversion Control that must approve the manufacture of OxyContin. Companies must submit requests, and then the office sets quotas on how much can be produced. Here's a quote from the Alternet piece. "In 1997, a year after prescription drug maker Purdue Pharma first bought OxyContin, the first branded version of oxycodone, the total production quota approved by the Office of Diversion Control was 8.3 tons. By 2011, it had risen to 105 tons, an officially sanctioned 1,200% increase. That's right. During the span of the medical marijuana era, 1997 to 2011, while they're trying to shut down every dispensary they possibly can, the DEA allowed Big Pharma to manufacture 1,200% more oxycodone. Now, Alternet's reporter then asked DEA Supervisory Special Agent Gary Boggs why the agency had greenlit a 1,200% increase in oxycodone manufacturing. Boggs's response is literally incredible. Quote, "What you have to understand is that you do have legitimate patients, and they're fishing from the same pond that the illegitimate patients are fishing from. So you have to be cautious not to restrict the quota to the point that when the legitimate parties go to the pool, all the fish haven't been taken out by the illegitimate parties." Quote. Try and imagine Eddie Lepp serving 10 years in a federal prison for medical marijuana cultivation in California, explaining that he needed to grow tens of thousands of medical marijuana plants in California so that the legitimate patients would have a supply after all the potheads got theirs. Don't think that would fly with the DEA. But when it comes to OxyContin, we have to produce a shit ton of it so that after all the pillheads get theirs, the legitimate patients will still have some. That's the DEA's excuse. Continuing from Alternet, Boggs acknowledged the limitations of the metaphor, but added, quote, We can't just be arbitrary and capricious in cutting the quota supply because we have a diversion problem, end quote. Arbitrary and capricious? Yeah, the DEA can be completely arbitrary and capricious. Those were the words of its own administrative law judge, Francis L. Young, in 1988, when he ruled the DEA was being arbitrary and capricious in denying the medical utility and accepted safety in the use of the cannabis plant. So we can't be arbitrary and capricious with respect to Big Pharma's drug, but Mother Nature's drug, all the arbitrariness and capriciosity you want can be thrown at that. I don't know if capriciosity is a word, but we're going with it. Concluding from the alternate piece, the fact is that the U.S. government has adopted a position on prescription painkillers that differs from its policy toward other controlled substances such as cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. Unlike those drugs, the DEA says limiting the supply of prescription painkillers will not reduce abuse. Yeah, yeah, because cocaine, heroin, and marijuana don't have lobbyists on Capitol Hill. It's all about the power of corporate lobbying. That's how a drug like oxycodone, a synthetic form of heroin, gets special treatment, despite being the number one gateway drug to heart abuse. That's how Florida's statewide prescription drug monitoring database, a system similar to those implemented in 34 other states, suffers defunding threats from its governor. The biggest irony in this whole story is that allowing patients to use medical marijuana eliminates most of the need for the oxycodone. A 2011 survey of the Berkeley Patients Group, a medical marijuana collective in California, found that 2/3 of its patients substituted cannabis for prescription drugs and, quote, those with pain symptoms said that marijuana has less addiction potential than do opioids, and others said marijuana helped to reduce the dose of other medications, end quote. And a 2004 study at Virginia Commonwealth University found, quote, a search for a better analgesic strategy led to the discovery that delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, the major psychoactive constituent of marijuana, enhances the potency of opioids such as morphine in animal models, end quote. It all about the money, people. They don't want medical marijuana to proliferate and take away the cash cow that is the oxycodone prescriptions that are funding these big pharmaceutical companies, getting their customers hooked and forcing them to keep coming back, paying more and more for their pain when there is a natural, safe, herbal alternative they can grow in their own damn backyards. The Tall Brothers said it best. Simply business. It's all about the business. That's all the time we got here for the Russ Belville Show, Hour 1. But stick with us as we go into Toker Talk Radio, Hour 2, where we'll take your calls at 971-533-7111. Got plenty to talk about. I'm going to rant a little bit more on a couple of those stories we covered today. I got to talk about this stupid Supreme Court decision. I can't believe it. They've made it even worse than it could have been. And more stories. So stick around for Brian the Red. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, take care of each other, Tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com.